This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhibi in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Maybe this vaccine may not stop you getting the sniffles, but this vaccine will stop you from dying or from going to hospital. And I think that's a very good and powerful vaccine, because that's going to help us keep our hospitals open and it's going to protect our healthcare workers.
That's South African infectious disease specialist Glenda Gray, who led a trial of the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine that arrived in the country today. Details coming up. Also, the first African and first female has been appointed Director General of the World Trade Organization. And Guinea has officially declared an Ebola epidemic. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, we start with our top story. Dr. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala yesterday became the first African and first female Director General of the World Trade Organization. Iweala, a former Nigerian finance minister and vice president of the World Bank, was elected as a consensus candidate by 164 members and 24 observers. Oke Onochukwu is a professor of economics at the University of Port Harcourt. He spoke to reporter Mike Nbonye about the appointment of Okonjo-Iweala's new role. He starts by talking about what it may mean for African nations and other developing economies.
Well, what that will do for Nigeria and Africa is just to boost our image, and not in terms of what we are going to benefit from trade, because the trade relationship between we and the advanced country is tilted towards the advantage of the advanced country, because what we actually produce is primary product. Take, for instance, Nigeria only produce crude oil and sell to the international world, not even refining the product any longer. So you know that if you don't do value addition to your product, your exports, your primary product export will only give you a stipend as compared to what other people gain by transforming their primary product into, finished product.
Do you think Dr. Iweala can mediate and find a solution to the U.S.-China trade war?
In terms of, negotiating, settling the trade relation between U.S. and China, I think that she has the capacity to do that. And Okonjo-Iweala is somebody that can be trusted, that she's usually very objective and straightforward in her dealings. I have confidence that she's going to do, very well.
What kind of reforms should the new Director General carry out at the World Trade Organization?
In terms of some reforms that will make the WTO better, I know that Okonjo-Iweala is also capable of bringing certain reforms that will, to an extent, better the lives of Africans and maybe start to encourage the African economy to add value to their product, which will help them gain from their trade relation with the rest of the world.
That was Oke Onochukwu, an economist at the University of Port Harcourt, speaking with reporter Mike Mbonye by telephone from Port Harcourt, Nigeria. The DRC recently announced a resurgence of cases of Ebola in the country after its 11th outbreak ended 3 months ago. Guinea has officially declared an Ebola epidemic 5 years after the epidemic in West Africa. For more, VOA's Leonard Boudou spoke with Dr. Nsenge Ngoi, Program Manager for Emergency Response at the WHO Regional Office for Africa.
Operationally, what we are intending to do in both cases is to stop the spread of Ebola as quickly as possible, to bring what we call, technically, to bring the outbreak under control. That's what we're doing now. So the measure to achieve that objective, they are the same. We need to win over the community to work with us and to be part of the response, and to abide by what we call public health measures, including at all cost avoid getting in touch with a body fluid of person who's sick or who has contracted Ebola. And obviously the other measure, including, thankfully, now we have a vaccine, include Vaccination of those contact, of the person who have been in contact with the sick person. And of course, we need to track the main contact, to follow the contact. Any person who has been in contact with the sick person to be followed at least for 21 days and make sure that if she or he falls sick, it doesn't transmit to the next person. So in terms of approach and strategy, there are not much difference, but at least it's very important to know which situation are we dealing with. Because, for instance, we know that the vaccine that we're using in DRC is effective in one space of Ebola. So knowing that it's the same space is very important. You can confidently vaccinate people knowing that they will be protected against that space of Ebola, and it will contribute to bring the outbreak as quickly as possible under control.
Looking at the COVID-19 outbreak, what are we looking at in terms of priorities?
I think public health-wise, there's no choosing between the two. They're all priorities. We need to deal with Ebola at the same time as we are dealing with the COVID-19. Obviously, as you can imagine, this is a challenge for the country. This is a challenge for our region. But we need to deal with this disease. But one hope, I can put it that way, one strength is for this region and for these countries, these are the outbreak they are kind of used to dealing with. So they have the capacity, they have the know-how, they have the institutional memory. So we are going to tap into that.
That was Dr. Nsenge Ngoi, Program Manager for Emergency Response at the WHO Regional Office for Africa, speaking with VOA's Lenore Mudu. The GS Sahel Summit has just ended in the Chadian capital in N'Djamena. For more on the outcome, VOA's Chinedu Ofor spoke with Katarina Hoya.
Expected troop withdrawal from France isn't happening. Instead, President Emmanuel Macron announced renewed or continued commitment with French troops with the Sahelian countries. What France is looking to do is to focus more on the fight against terrorism and also allowing for the Sahelian countries to move in to rebuild the government presence, move in with economic development where France has pushed back the militants.
Do you think the meeting could have achieved more? Was there a sense of disappointment?
I believe the fact that there's not a scale back of the French presence in the Sahel is probably what the West African leaders were looking for. I mean, we know it's a difficult area to be operating in. We're also going to see the addition of 1,200 Chadian troops. What we are waiting for is the European joint force known as Takuba, who is supposed to give support to the French troop and also conduct more operations in the regions, as the French are focusing more on the fight against terrorists.
Aside from the military commitments, any economic commitment for France?
No new economic commitments at this point. Most of the commitments were made last year. Some of the funds have been made available to the West African countries, the Sahelian states, but we're still awaiting a large portion of the funds that still have not reached the countries. And obviously, without the funds, issues such as economic development and humanitarian aid won't be available until those funds are also made available.
That was reporter Katarina Hoya speaking with VOA's Chinedu Ofor. 80,000 doses of Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine are expected to land today and kickstart South Africa's immunization program aimed at ending its pandemic. South Africa has been the worst affected by coronavirus on the continent, with almost 1.5 million infections and 48,000 deaths. The first batch of J&J jabs is to be sent to 16 hospitals around the country, where they will be given to healthcare workers. Darren Taylor reports.
infectious diseases specialist Glenda Gray led a trial of the J&J Ad26 vaccine at the height of South Africa's second wave of COVID-19. Those infections and deaths, which continue today, were driven by the highly infectious 501Y V2 variant first identified in the country in December. Gray believes the Ad26 jab suits South Africa because it only needs one dose to work and can be stored at normal fridge temperature.
The single-shot vaccine, irrespective of what region you are in the world, has protected against hospitalization and death. So yes, maybe this vaccine may not stop you getting the sniffles, but this vaccine will stop you from dying or from going to hospital. And I think that's a very good and powerful vaccine because that's going to help us keep our hospitals open and it's going to protect our healthcare workers.
The first batch will be injected into doctors, nurses, and other healthcare givers, even though it hasn't been approved yet by international medicine regulators such as the World Health Organization.
Although we know the vaccine works, you're in a kind of regulatory no man's land. One could always just wait for the vaccine to be registered, but that would be 12 weeks away.
Gray says it would be inhumane not to administer a jab that's scientifically proven to work against the variant simply because of red tape. Therefore, the health department will allow it to be given to healthcare workers on a trial basis.
That's what we would call a phase 3B study. And the 3B is how do you execute the rollout program. So it's much more about learning about how you roll it out rather than learning about whether it works or not.
Nevertheless, some in the healthcare sector are upset that they're expected to take an unapproved vaccine. Gray says they've nothing to worry about. But nursing unions remain adamant they won't allow their members to be used as guinea pigs.
What we're doing is that we're accelerating the timeline to give vaccines to healthcare workers because they need it before the next wave comes. This vaccine will protect them from dying and protect them from being hospitalized. I can't see how being protected from death and hospitalization is making you a guinea pig.
The state says it won't force anyone to be vaccinated, but Gray hopes healthcare givers will consider the benefits of the Ad26 shot.
The data speaks for itself. My researchers who are working on this vaccine have asked me, Glenda, can we be first in line? Can we take the vaccine? Can we get it? And so if the researchers who worked on the vaccine want to be the first to take it, that is evidence that there's huge trust by the scientific community to take the vaccine because they've seen what it did. I want to be first in line to take the vaccine.
The government expects 500,000 J&J vaccines to arrive in South Africa by April and to have enough shots soon thereafter to inoculate 250,000 people in healthcare. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
10 years ago, Libya's uprising erupted amid demands for a modern democracy after more than 40 years of dictatorship under Muammar Gaddafi. Instead, Libya suffered a decade of chaos and internal fighting as it became a theater for regional and foreign intervention. The new U.S. administration has called for the immediate withdrawal of Russian, Turkish, and other foreign forces. Essam Omish, president of the Libyan American Alliance, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi what went wrong in Libya after the uprising of February 17, 2011.
I think looking back after 10 years of a Libyan revolution that has come after 42 years of an authoritarian rule in Libya, that has left Libya basically decimated without any political structure and without any institutions, state institutions. And after essentially what was a very brutal dictatorship, unfortunately, it set Libya for a failure. One of the things we saw after the UN-backed Western-led military intervention in Libya is that they didn't complete the job. I think part of it was more of a regime change without extensive plan for post-regime change. And I think that left Libya somewhat hanging in the middle of all the situation. When you see that without further planning from the Western powers that were part of that intervention, and when you see a state that has no institutions and has no political system that allows it to reverse course from the demise of these institutions after a dictatorship. Unfortunately, that was what played out in Libya. And that vacuum, unfortunately, was worsened by the extensive presence of weapons, the development of militias, the lack of ability to absorb these tens of thousands of militiamen. And then it was exacerbated by foreign power intervention and proxy wars that have devolved essentially from the conflict. So it has been, unfortunately, a combination of many things that has led to what went wrong in Libya.
The Biden administration has called for the immediate withdrawal of Russian, Turkish, and other foreign forces from Libya. What's your take on that?
I think if we look at the principle of withdrawing all foreign powers and mercenaries from Libya, that is absolutely essential as a long-term solution to the Libyan conflict. But I think the Biden administration may be correct, and then we saw the deputy U.S. ambassador at the UN, Mr. Mills, call for the same thing, and he specifically mentioned Russia, Turkey, and he added actually the UAE also to exit from Libya. I think what we need to do is we need to have three steps, which I think would help address this issue clearly. The first step is to identify really who are the foreign backers that have been financing and bankrolling this mercenary presence in Libya. And if we do that, I think we can identify the culprits of this extremely increased presence of mercenaries. I think the UAE, unfortunately, along with Saudi Arabia and other culprits, have been key in financing this presence of foreign powers. The second thing that I think we need to do is to address the countries that are not playing at the international theater, if you may. I mean, when you talk about Russia and Turkey, there's way too many complex formulas that need to be invoked and addressed along with the US and the EU in order to resolve this issue. So we need to address the middle level states that are not part of the international complexity. And I mean, Sudan, Chad, there's been some reports of Gambia possibly, you know, sending some mercenaries. Those countries need to be held back. They need to be held accountable. And we need to remove these forces from Libya. That leaves us with the last most difficult part, which is the Russian and the Turkish forces. And that, unfortunately, cannot be resolved without really the heavy weight of the international community resolving these issues with an eye on what's in stake for every power of the international powers that are involved, and the U.S. also exerting its heavy weight to try to see resolution to this. I think what we will see, hopefully, is a incremental, stepwise withdrawal of the mercenaries and the forces that have been brought in by Russia and Turkey, namely the Syrian forces from both sides, need to be slowly scaled back. And then, of course, the Wagner mercenaries, first, they need to be addressed by Russia, because Russia, till this day, unfortunately, as a state, disclaims any ownership of the issue. And it says, yeah, they may be Russian nationals, but they're not part of the Russian state's army. But that needs to be addressed. And the Wagners have to be withdrawn in sync with their agreements with the Turks, because they are the other strongest force on the ground. But both, they need to be consistent with the goals of the EU and the US, because military Russian presence in Libya is frowned upon, and it's looked upon as a red line for the Western powers. And Russia has to be remedied in a different way, maybe arguably through commercial and through financial gains in Libya that would prevent them from having a military presence. I think the Turks would be the easiest, even though they have a lot of stake in Libya, because they came through agreements with a government that's legitimate and that it's approved. And they have repeatedly expressed their interest in leaving the Libyans so long as the mandate of their presence, which is protecting Libyans and stopping the demise of the democratic path in Libya and standing against those who were fighting the legitimate government. Once those issues are over, I think the military and security presence will be not completely gone, but less, and hopefully translated more, and again, commercial and economic interests, as well as the maritime agreements with Libya.
That was Essam Omish, president of the Libyan American Alliance, speaking with my colleague, Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Reuters reports that a passenger barge carrying more than 700 people has sunk on the Congo River, very close to the capital, Kinshasa. The Democratic Republic of Congo's humanitarian affairs minister, Steve Mbakai, wrote on Twitter that 300 survivors have been rescued, while another 240 remain unaccounted for. He wrote that officials demand sanctions against all those responsible in the transport sector, without elaborating. Deadly boat accidents are common in Congo, which has few paved roads across its vast forested interior and where boats are frequently loaded well beyond their capacity. For most people, the Congo River and its tributaries are the only means of traveling long distances. The UN Human Rights Office says it is concerned by a new Human Rights Watch report that says Zimbabwe's government is using the COVID-19 pandemic as a pretext to clamp down on freedom of expression and freedom of peaceful assembly and association. Some of the victims of the alleged clampdown have welcomed the UN agency's statement but want the Zimbabwe government to halt human rights abuses and concentrate on citizens' concerns during lockdown to contain coronavirus, which has infected about 35,000, including 1,382 deaths. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Mother Yutado, the spokeswoman of the UN Human Rights Office, said the agency was encouraging President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government to engage with civil society and other stakeholders to find sustainable solutions to grievances while ensuring that people's rights and freedoms are protected in accordance with Zimbabwe's human rights obligations.
We are indeed concerned at allegations that suggest that the Zimbabwean authorities may be using the COVID-19 pandemic as a pretext to clamp down on freedom of expression and freedom of peaceful assembly and association. Merely calling for a peaceful protest or participating in a peaceful protest are an exercise of recognized human rights. An example of intimidation is the repeated arbitrary arrest and detention of three members of the main opposition party for taking part in a protest.
That is an apparent reference to three female opposition activists who were arrested in May for protesting the Zimbabwe government's failure to provide payouts during a lockdown to contain the coronavirus. They now face two more charges, all related to breaking lockdown regulations. On Thursday, HRW released a report chronicling how 23 African governments are using the COVID-19 pandemic to clamp down on freedom of the media and of assembly. On Friday, Cecilia Chimbiri, one of the three female opposition activists mentioned in the HRW report, welcomed the UN Human Rights Office's statement on Zimbabwe. She maintains the trio's innocence and wants Zimbabwe government to look after its citizens during lockdowns.
The demo was simply because we were saying people are hungry. What are you doing as the government of Zimbabwe? People are unemployed. Zimbabweans live hand to mouth. We are law-abiding citizens. Speaking against the government doesn't make us unpatriotic. We love our country. This is why we are speaking against any injustices and any inequalities that are existing. We did not commit any crime. We are not criminals. They're trying to tarnish our images. This is what this government is doing, to clamp down voices, to make sure that they continue doing that.
On Wednesday, Elasto Mugwadi, the head of the government-affiliated Zimbabwe Human Rights Commission, confirmed to VOA that his organization had received complaints about abuses raised in the HRW report. He said the complaints included robust approach in enforcement by the police and generally excessive enforcement. Mugwadi said the commission was investigating the complaints about abuses during the lockdown by the Zimbabwe government to contain coronavirus. In her statement, Yutado of the UN Human Rights Office said,
while recognizing the government's efforts to contain the pandemic, it's important to remind the authorities that any restrictions should be necessary, proportionate, and time-limited, and enforced humanely without resorting to unnecessary or excessive force.
The HRW report, COVID-19 triggers wave of free speech abuse, said the rights group was concerned about Zimbabwe's introduction of Public Health Order Act in March, which threatened up to 20 years in prison for fake news on public health matters. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. I'm behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.